So this is a reading from a book by M.J. Caldwell called Am I My Brother's Keeper? And he was a United Church minister and also one of the early leaders of the CCF and an MP. All the great religions are concerned with human behavior and human relationships. Hence it follows that politics and religion cannot be considered as separate aspects of human relationships and behavior. Just as we unite in our respective churches for common worship, using common forms which we believe to be best suited to the objectives we have in mind, so men and women with common ideals and objectives unite in political parties and movements to attain those ideals and objectives at which they aim. Both are concerned with human conduct. Christ himself summarized the relationship thus, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." It's the second time we've heard about the second commandment. While the primary purpose of political policies which conform to the principles of Christianity is not to secure the material welfare of individual citizens, they should seek that goal as a means to provide the maximum opportunities for the development of human personality. Hence, to my mind, the Christian gospel is essentially a social gospel, concerned not only with a future existence beyond the grave, but our immediate environment, which should provide the means for the development of character and personality. Because I believe this, I think that a major objective of political activity must be to give to every citizen a background of health, security, and leisure, without which self-development is well nigh impossible. It follows, too, that these together must form part of that basis of individual liberty which will provide the opportunity for the exercise of those abilities and gifts with which we are each endowed. But if we are each going to have the right to exercise our individual gifts and abilities, the society in which we live in must have our support in guaranteeing to all the same rights as we wish to possess ourselves. That, indeed, is the basis of democracy. True democracy.
So you may perhaps be wondering whose picture it is. It's on the front of the Order of Service. I don't actually know her name. I always think of her as the peanut lady. When Molly and I were in Dar es Salaam a few years ago, she had her stall just outside the place where we live. And every day on my way home from work, I'd buy two little packages of peanuts from her for about 8 cents Canadian each. So if you want to make an estimate of her daily income, you can count the number of peanuts in her inventory, peanut bags in her inventory, and I think there are about 25 or 30 there, so 8 cents each. That's a total gross revenue of somewhere between $2 and $2.40. But of course, she'd have to buy the peanuts somewhere else and make them up. So that's her net income. If she sold them all, it would be considerably less. And of course, this is in one of the best off neighborhoods in the capital city, which is the best off place in the entire country. So she would have been significantly better off than most other elderly women in Dar es Salaam, and certainly most elderly women in rural areas of the country where most people live. And so that's what happens when you don't have pensions. That's what happens when you don't have a welfare state. Something like 4% of Tanzanians over 65 have a pension. So the concept of retirement really doesn't exist. You work till you draw. You hope that you can live with an extended family, and you hope that they can treat you well. And if they do, then it's a form of shared poverty. And that is what happens in poor countries which haven't been able to develop as rich countries have. a welfare state. And the very first origins of the welfare state in Bismarck's Germany, Bismarck's Prussia in the 1880s, and Austria in 1908, and Canada in the 1920s, was to have some attempt to provide some security in old age for people. Because security in old age is important not just for the people who are actually old at any particular point in time, but also for everybody else who kind of hopes to end up old, right? Because the alternative to being getting older is even worse. And so if security in old age is important because it shapes your anticipations of the future, what you can look forward to, what is your life at some point in the present, some point in the future. Because we don't really just live in the present. If you think about it, the present is just this kind of nanosecond of direct experience which separates the anticipated future from the remembered past. And the thing is that if you don't have a secure future to look forward to, a lot of people spend a lot of that just nanosecond worrying about their futures. And insecurity about the economic events isn't just something that is limited to poor people. Middle class people worry about their place in society, whether they can make the mortgage payments, whether they can pay their bills. Poor people, of course, insecurity, their lives are much more insecure than richer people in general. But you're way better off if you've got a dependable pension or some other dependable source of income, then if you have to worry each week or each month about whether the little that you have will be taken away. So, in that sense, security and anxiety about the future is a huge impact on well-being. And it's not just, about security in old age. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, said in Article 22 that everyone, as a member of society, has a right to social security. In Article 25, it reads a bit funny because they use the male pronoun because that's the way people talked in 1948. And they say in Article 2 that all rights are equally guaranteed to male and female persons, but it says, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood and circumstances beyond his control. And this, that idea of security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, or old age, those hazards that face every one of us in our lives, which are very uncertain and risky, and which we can't necessarily avoid or insure against or mitigate too well. That's what I want to focus on, and that's in fact what the welfare state does focus on. Because if you look at what governments in rich countries spend money on, actually, what they're spending money on, most of the actual expenditure, is on providing some insurance against these hazards of life. It's a mistake, I think, to think of governments as really as redistributing primarily from rich to poor. What they really do is redistribute in the same very same way that insurance companies redistribute. From the lucky to the unlucky. I've been paying fire insurance premiums on my house for 40-some years now. Never made a claim. And that's okay by me. I've also been, the province of Nova Scotia pays a bunch of money every year for hospitals and for cardiac surgeons. And I've never made any use of the services of cardiac surgeons. And I haven't spent much time in hospital. But I'm perfectly okay with the idea that those services are there. It's the unlucky among us who have to take advantage of those services and their bills. It's the lucky among us who get to pay the premiums and pay the taxes for them. And so, but I do derive a benefit from those cardiac surgeons who are waiting over there with their instruments. I do derive a benefit, and that's called peace of mind. And that's important to my well-being today. And it's important partly because well-being as an individual, and partly because it gives you that sense of safety from which you can build relationships with others. So I think that governments in rich countries are primarily to be seen as massive insurance schemes, massive ways in which we pool risk in a very uncertain world. And of course, in poor countries, they have both lower incomes and much less security, which is how I kind of got into this topic of economic insecurity, because I was interested in measuring the idea of economic well-being, what it's like. So, with the colleagues, it's constructed an index of economic well-being, which has four components: average incomes, the sustainability of incomes, the inequality of incomes, and an index of economic insecurity. And you can find it on the web if you're ever interested. It's called the Index of Economic Well-Being. And it has one of this index in it, measured across countries and over time, of how insecure different countries are, because countries differ a lot in the extent to which they help insure us against an uncertain future. And I was kind of surprised when a British academic used that index to explain the obesity epidemic. Because he is arguing that the thing we have to think about when we think about the increasing prevalence of obesity is why did it happen, and where and when it did happen. Because rich countries have had enough income for a calorie-rich environment for a long time. And the obesity epidemic really only started going in the 1980s. And lots of places have enough income so that people could buy enough food to get really fat, but not everyone of them does. I mean, the Scandinavian countries, for example, have far less obesity than the United States. So he used our index to try to explain these international differences, and it turns out that the index of economic security explains a little less than half of the difference in the prevalence of obesity across countries. And if you look at that data on individuals, you find the same thing. There's lots of surveys out there in the world today which follow individuals over time, so you can measure how much they gained weight before and after an increase in their economic insecurity. And for example, in Canada, we had a big reform by which unemployment insurance got retitled as employment insurance in the mid-1990s, and benefits got cut quite a bit. And for people who are at risk of unemployment, that's a big increase in their economic insecurity. And yes, they do gain significantly more weight in the less secure environment than in the after 1995, than in the more secure environment before 1995. And the same stuff comes out of data in the United States on people at risk of unemployment. And in fact, a big sort of natural experiment, as we call it in economics, in China was the end of the Iron Rice Bowl. Something like 85 million people worked in these state-owned enterprises. And then all of a sudden, 34 million of them got laid off in the late 1990s. And so you can measure the weight of not just even the parents, but also the children in those families. And then the families that became more insecure, even the ones that didn't actually lose their own jobs, that just had to worry more about their jobs, they get fatter at a very significantly fatter rate. More for males than for females, it turns out. And of course, there is a quite a reasonable biological reason, because the ability to store fat is a survival mechanism for animals that have an anticipation, a possibility of insufficient food at some point in the future. And in fact, we have all sorts of feast days in our culture, which are remnants of the idea where people couldn't really store food very well back in the day. So at harvest time, you had great big Thanksgivings and Christmas feasts, and you put on a little weight after the harvest, and then you lost it again over the period before the next crop came in. And in food deficient times, it's not really a problem, but when calories are constantly available, the economic anxiety, the worry about the future that stresses people on a day-to-day basis. Well, we've all heard the phrase comfort food, eh? The idea that you get that if you eat a bunch of poutine, for example, you just feel good, temporarily. But the stress is always there, right? And so when the stress is always there and that self-medicating mechanism is always there, then people get put on a lot of weight. And of course, it's not just obesity, but it's also mental health. You stress people enough repeatedly, over and over and over again, worrying about their futures. There's a major impact on depressive episodes. And again, also impacts on children. Families that are under economic stress in Canada turn to less functional parenting behaviors. They're more punitive. They're more less able to interact with their kids, and their kids show up with anxieties and all sorts of problems in school. So there are huge health impacts of greater economic insecurity, which you can prove in a very rigorous econometric ways, which add to the cost of economic insecurity in ways that aren't just reflected in the day-to-day worries of individuals. And so the bad news is that we've had for quite a long time pushes in our society and in a lot of societies to lessen the protections of the welfare state economic insecurity. We've seen lessened protections in unemployment insurance. We've seen cuts to social assistance. We've seen a big shift to defined contribution pension plans. Only a few Canadians in the private sector actually have the defined benefit pension plans anymore. The good news, of course, from that is that we actually do know a lot about how to reduce economic insecurity. Those are policies that can be reversed. We have old age pensions in Canada. We have the Canada Pension Plan. We have the Guaranteed Income Supplement. And we don't have people selling peanuts on the sidewalk because we had political action that established those policies. So, maybe I'll have a bit more to say, and that is that two other things. So I won't stop there. And that is that it's not clear in the future that the politics of solidarity will dominate the politics of envy. When only a quarter of private sector workers in Canada have defined benefit, have private pensions, and only 60% of them are defined benefit, that means only 15% of private sector workers in Canada have a defined benefit pension plan. So public sector workers tend to have good pensions. So when only a few have what everyone needs, how does our society respond? Do we level down because they've got it, why do they have it? Or do we level up to what everybody needs? And if we think about the politics of envy and the politics of solidarity, the health and well-being impacts on individuals of increased economic insecurity can be rigorously measured and rigorously assessed, and you can say with a lot of certainty that they're there. But maybe that's the smaller impact. Maybe some of the bigger impacts of greater economic insecurity, and which really represents a form of fear of the future, maybe that turns really around political events. It's harder to be absolutely rigorously certain that a greater economic insecurity lies behind the rise of what some people call right-wing populism, what is more accurately called xenophobic authoritarianism, the Trump phenomenon, the Le Pen phenomenon. But when people are insecure and fear for their economic future, there's a real danger that they turn to demagogues and scapegoating as a way of thinking that this can solve their problems. But then again, Pauli tells me I should end on a positive note. We do have to always remember that we know how to solve this problem. And we did it before, to some degree, perhaps not as much as we should, but to a large degree, through political action. So.